ran over to the lawyer next door. He's a lawyer in Belmont Hotel in Kodiak here. And he ran over to Coffee and said, "But you know about that old man that he actually wanted to fight." The dentist said that to the lady. "Oh, you ran up against Antonio, miss. We're on up against the window. A bus saw you through out of the window."
"You ran up against the Antonio?"
"Ran up against the bus saw." And he got his money back. So he got and then he got a ride on the Pilgrim, Arthur Hawkins, and Oscar Nelson. And I don't know how many was on the boat. And he threw the anchor and he hollered and his false teeth went overboard.
He could see it.
Right, and he could see them, you know, that's where the ashes was on the end or the bow tie. Yeah. Wasn't that deep of water where he could get them. So I guess somebody put it in the newspaper that Antone diving for 6 fathoms of water for his false feet. And it was in every newspaper he could ever. He got a lot of newspapers and everybody, his sister from Norway and his sister from Wisconsin, sent him clippings of the Antone diving for his false 6 fathoms of water. And he had all these newspapers given to him. That's the story about his false teeth. Then he went to another dentist and he got good false teeth back.
Well, was the pair that fell over there for the first pair or the second pair?
The first pair.
The first pair. Mm-hmm. Before he got his money back.
Yeah.
He
went right away before that funny thing. That was the second. But he got used to those. With the first pair that he went to had to deal with Coffee with the lawyer. And the Belmont here in Korea.
That's a good story, Grandma.
That's good. Him, but he used to write to them. He had mail all over the post office. It was plugged up with mail for them.
Who, Tony Diamond?
Tony Diamond and Richardson.
Yeah. Grandpa had mail from
Yeah.
Who, Anson?
Yeah.
Had mail from Tony Diamond?
Yeah. Oh. Usually they get 50 cents a bounty for Eagle Claws because they pick up our lamb. The cow had a calf and
you should tell her the story about Grandpa losing his teeth overboard and it was in the newspapers all over the country.
It was?
No, I don't know.
That's a good story.
Don't tell me.
Well,
do you remember what year it was?
I don't remember what year it was, but...
How old were you?
Should I put the tape back in?
Yeah, it's a good story.
Okay.
I know why they had so many sore knees.
Working so hard.
I guess so. Yeah. I know he fixed all their knees and healed them with mutton tallow and carbolic acid.
With mutton what?
Mutton tallow.
Mutton sheep fat. Lamb fat or something, what do you call it?
He was a doctor, huh?
But he read so many books, he got it out of doctor books.
Oh, really? He just learned a lot.
Yeah.
Was he educated? Did he go to school in Norway?
He said that when he was going to school in Norway, they had to be home till after they go to school, and they had to learn the Bible. After they learned the Bible, the Norwegians take off and be on their own.
Huh.
They're not coming back.
because all the boys, the girls stayed home.
Mm. But the boys left.
The boys left.
Mm. That's interesting.
Mm-hmm. He said one time he got stewed away by some Mexicans.
Oh, this is a good story.
Uh-huh. And he ran away with it, and he didn't, they got, took him away from home. And then he was away from home as a little boy, I guess 13, 14 years old. And all these Mexicans, they were chewing snuff or chewing tobacco or something.
Mm-hmm.
And they cook rice, and they put it all in one big platter. And they all eat out of the one platter with their one same spoon. And they, when they used the spoon and showed in the rice, you know, the black spots, Dad saw that, he could almost cry and miss home. And he said that his mother didn't know where he was. And he looking at that rice, and it was his turn to go and eat, but he was all homesick. There was his mother standing at the door. Why did he say he felt good to see her?
What, and she showed up?
Yeah.
Oh.
Then he, his mother was waiting, looking for him. She found where he was.
Mm.
And she found where he was. He never ran away from home anymore.
Oh, he ran away.
But this, he didn't run away, but he said that Uncle Martin ran away. Uncle Martin ran away. Rika told me that. Did he ever tell you? He said he never told us. But their Stamness's brothers told her that he had ran away when he was 13 years old. And he never told the family that.
Hmm.
Peter, his oldest son, is gambling, and I guess he chased him out of the house because he was a night owl.
Mm.
And Peter left home because he used to not stay out, not mine.
Mm.
Yeah, Uncle Martin chased him out for the girl. Oh, he had a big family, Uncle Martin. Used to go over there on the island.
Me and a father?
Uh-huh. Had lots of kids. I guess it was 10.
10 kids, huh?
Mm-hmm.
10 kids, what happened to them all?
Well, Tina, Rika, Sonia, Phoebe, Neil, Carl, and me, and Martha, and Lawrence. Oh, this was 9 or 10. 10 of us all together sitting around the table.
Wow.
Playing cards and getting.
I bet that was fun.
Uh-huh. Going across, and we used to pick ducks. Boy, that's a big job. I had to pick this stuff, and Johnny picked them most of the time. He picked all. Johnny's job was picked cute ducks, load the shells. We sure loaded our own shells. First time I went out to shoot the gun when Dad left, took the 10-gauge gun, the 10-gauge shotgun, went down to the beach. A bunch of ducks shot, knocked me over, all black and blue. Then when Dad came home, I wondered why I was so black and blue. I told him I should have took the gun, and that's what happened. You didn't brace yourself. You have to know how to brace yourself when you shoot a gun. He showed me how to stand up and how to put my foot at the back. And, brace yourself. Hang on to it. I pulled two triggers at the two gun barrels. Went up. We loaded our own shell.
You got to tell her about how Grandpa used to make his own hair coloring.
Oh yeah, he had, well, he was a ladies' man. He looked like, you know, Hitler, particularly. Let's see about his looks. Anyway, he was so firm, sage, and he used his Is her hair turned darker?
Color of his eyes.
Well, I think we're done. All you and Larson, you know, Mama's husband. He went over to visit him because he came from Trondheim, Norway, too. He's a Norwegian. Come up and have coffee with him because he comes from Norway. And he liked Norwegian people. He didn't see very many Norwegians. He was glad to see somebody from Norway. So he used to go up and have a cup of coffee with him. And Johnny told us that Papa was over and told Mama, he called Mama too. Mama's husband, Louis Larson, he said that Mama was delicious apple but the Holy Torah.
The Holy Torah. Oh, funny. What did Louis say?
Well, they were good friends. I don't know. He was nice to us, too.
He probably agreed.
Uh-huh. But Mama was a hard case. She's been running around, too. I remember her boyfriend.
Wait, that's when Grandpa was gone?
Yeah, no, when even though she sent her to town to go and celebrate to keep her away from this, she went any time she wanted to go, she went on a little trip. But she had all kinds of friends.
Mm-hmm. I need to get your address. I can't remember, P.O. Box
183?
783, right.
Yeah, how come
I'm
mixed up?
I don't know, I'm mixed up too.
Uh-huh.
Probably because we've been thinking about the old days.
Yeah. It's hard to think of old ones. But anyway.
Could you sign that? Just saying that it's okay if I write this up?
Pleasure.
Right here. This means it says, can I read this to you? It says, I hereby give and grant to the... Go ahead, tell me about the stuffing and the beans and...
Well, when we used to make pickled herring, pickled beets for you, eating with salmon and fish cakes and garlic, and we used 2 parts of vinegar and 1 part of water and a spoonful of brown sugar and boil that and then cool it. And then when we put a layer of spice, a layer of herring, or then onions, and a layer of spice, and then onions, and
white
onions,
or yellow onions?
The white onions are the best for pickling.
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. And then be sure that the vinegar and water that's been boiled is cool when you pour it over it.
Mm.
And then just let them sit for a couple of weeks before you eat them. And they were really delicious.
What's that called?
Herring. Pickled herring.
Pickled herring. Did your dad teach you how to make that?
Uh-huh. Oh. He did that. And you could pickle. We pick up beets with the same vinegar and
that over 1 part of water?
Yeah, but no
brown sugar?
Yeah, no onions or any no spice, just pickling.
Oh, no spice for the beets.
Just the vinegar and sugar and the water, vinegar and sugar.
Oh.
And then boil it and cool it. And fill your jars with pickles, beets, and that's been cooked, you know, and pour this over and season them. And when you eat fish, boy, that was good. Do the fish or something.
Mm-hmm.
Pickled beets.
Mm-hmm.
That was good. And then when we made head cheese, we skinned the head, wore the fur off, and took the ice off the eye of the head, and cut it up in small, in maybe 4 pieces, and put it in a great big cooker, and cook it.
You got another tape on
it. I did. And then cook it till it fall off, the bones fall off the meat, and then cut it up fine and put it in bread pans or wherever you want to make head cheese, you know. Put a little salt in the cooking, and then, but don't freeze it after.
Mm-hmm.
Just keep it in a cool place.
What kind of spices do you use?
We use whole spices in cheesecloth rolled up the bottom of the cooker.
Oh.
That is seasoned. That's all we use, salt and spice.
What kind of spice?
Huh?
What kind of spice?
All mixed spices. The whole spice.
Pickled spices?
Yeah, uh-huh.
Yeah.
That's all.
Yeah.
And then don't freeze it. Keep it in a good place. And that was good cheese. But don't put too much water on it to cover it until it dropped off. And that made good red cheese.
All the
gelatin. Yeah, uh-huh. It gels by itself. That's how to make head cheese.
Good, now we have the recipe.
Uh-huh. Then for duck stuffing, we used liver, hearts, and liver and hearts, and the gizzard, grind it up, and then some dry bread or toast, and then an apple, and so on, then little salt and pepper, you know. Well, then that made good stuffing for ducks, and sew them up and roast them.
Ooh, yum.
Mm-hmm. That was a big dinner.
Thanksgiving?
No, we used the other things for Thanksgiving, probably kill a pig or something.
Oh.
Roast pork or something. We had a lot of pigs. People come over for Thanksgiving, all the pioneers.
We had a beautiful voice.
Huh? They were all singing. All the pioneers had a really good time at the island, coming to see Dad, visiting him. I didn't tell you all that. But that's, we used to, the tiger, from Tiger Cape, Inwaloo used to come over, what a great guy. We laughed so hard that he couldn't talk, walk anymore. Why, he was a comical guy.
You don't care about Inwaloo. We used to call him
Tiger.
Tiger from...
He ate so much cod liver, or fresh liver from codfish. And like codfish, that he got strong like a tiger.
Uh-huh.
And he called that place Tiger Cape. He named it.
Oh.
His Inwaloo, his dad's friends from Norway. Old pioneer. I'd like to have a pioneer picture to put in there with all their names. You have a pioneer picture?
Mm-hmm.
Ah. They must have them in the...
They probably have
somewhere
at the museum.
Uh-huh, and I'm afraid Lawrenson got one with the name.
They got them at the museum.
Uh-huh. We try to get one of them to put in the old pioneer.
He was a member of the pioneer.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. You could get them old pioneers in 90. They took a picture in a fog night. Of the pioneers.
Oh, that's that.
1918. No, way before that.
1898.
Oh, 1800. Well, anyway, long time ago. So you think you got a good recording, huh?
I think so, Grandma.
Uh-huh.
Thanks. I suppose I should get back to work.
Yeah. Well, that was nice.
Which is true. purely a matter of choice, you know, you could make a pretty good case for the most important element being style or tone. Or you could even make a case for it being simple. That simple idea so pervades that story as to make the entire story revolve around that symbol of immortality, of perfection. And I'm not going to grade you according to which one you choose. There's more than one way to skin a cat, and there's certainly more than one way to look at short story. So which do you choose as the most important? It's not nearly so important as how well you support that choice. And you support it by using concrete details. Don't talk in abstractions any more than you have to. And each time you make an abstract assertion, you need to come right behind it, back it up with some concrete supporting quote. Something concrete. You all know the difference between concrete and abstract fiction. Well, I'll use those further words around. Some of you may not. I mean, it's no shame if you don't. But if you don't, how many of you are not comfortable with those terms? Concrete and abstract. Okay. Then let me just mention briefly what I mean by those terms. In expository writing, which is all the kind of writing that you're going to do in college, not just in English, but in economics, history, and government, and any course that involves writing, the most important single thing that you can do in writing is to tend toward concrete rather than abstract fiction. Now, here's the difference. Abstract fiction is language that has to be perceived intellectually. You have to intellectualize it. It appeals to the brain, in other words, okay? The words, say, education. Education is an abstraction, isn't it? Alright? Well, let me tell you what concrete is, and then you'll be able to see better what I mean by abstract. Concrete diction is diction language that appeals to the senses, the five senses. Sight, taste, touch, smell, and hearing. Okay? That's concrete diction. For example, notice in this part of the description on 686, when he starts talking about this room, some down the bottom, some few ottomans. Is an ottoman something that you can see? Sure is. That's a physical object, isn't it? It's a footstool. That's concrete. What if you just said furniture? Furniture
can have
a
slab,
isn't
it?
Because furniture could be a lot of things.
Yeah.
Alright? He said there's a lot of furniture in the room. Yeah, furniture is kind of concrete, but if it's just furniture, what image do you have in your mind? It could be a bed, a sofa, a chair, a table, a footstool. Lots of things qualify as furniture, right? So a few ottomans and golden candelabra. There's another specific image. An Eastern figure wearing various stations about. And there was a couch, too. The bridal couch of an Indian Muslim. Blah, 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 blah. Even smells and sounds he describes in concrete detail. So concrete language is that which appeals to the senses, is perceived by the senses, things that you can see and touch and taste and smell. Abstraction has to be intellectualized. Can you see or touch or taste or hear or smell education? No. Democracy. Freedom. Even sadness, even emotions like sadness, joy, those are abstractions. If you're going to tell me somebody was sad, instead of saying he's sad, show me him being sad. show me that person doing things a sad person does. He's crying. Ah, there's a, that's something concrete, right?
Mm-hmm.
Crying's concrete. He was screaming at the top of his lungs, wailing at the moon. There's a concrete thing, he's right. He was digging in the snow. So rather than it's always better to show than to tell. And when you use concrete words, you show. When you use abstractions, you tell. And there are times when you have to tell. You got to say, the theme of this story is the fear of death and the desire for immortality. Well, now that's an abstraction all the way, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And when you're talking, see, themes are almost always expressed in abstractions. Major ideas are usually expressed in abstractions. But the job of the writer is to take those abstractions and then to make them concrete by associating them with the things that represent them, the things that signify those abstractions, the physical things. So that's what you need to think about. And if your paper does that, then it'll get, you know, tears and grains and all that. Even if you're way off base in your assertions, really, you can get away with some ridiculous assertions sometimes if they're well written. A lot of teachers would go, yeah. I mean, I know that's there's no possibility that that's what this story is about, but it's really well done and well presented, and the writer does a good job of supporting. Okay? So, you know, what you think of the story is really irrelevant. How good a job you do of expressing what you think, supporting what you think in concrete terms, that's what the papers are. Think about that. And if you have questions about that concept or are still uncomfortable with it, well, you know, we'll have time to come soon and set up a form and we'll talk about it. Okay. Follow the hound of usher. Point of view. What's the point of view here? Once again, first person. Now, how do you feel about the reliability of this narrator, say, as opposed to the narrator's life he does? Think he's pretty reliable. Yeah, I kind of get that feeling too, because here the crazy guy is Robert Gusher.
Yeah.
Who's being described. So here we've got two primary characters, and we've got a third, the sister Marguerite. She has a brief appearance. And she says she's definitely a flat character. She's a flat character. Madeline's a flat character. What about the narrator? Is the narrator flat or round? Flat. We don't know very much about this narrator. All we know about him, really, is that he and Robert Gusher were friends when they were children. We don't know very much about him. We don't know his name, what he does for a living, with anything. We don't know where he lives. We don't know if he's married or not, if he has kids or not. We don't know what he wants. Remember, I said that the thing he asked of his character is, what does this character want? Well, really, all of his wants can be boiled down to one real simple thing. He just wants to make his friend Robert feel better. Okay. Which is, you know, that's the sort of thing anybody could want, right? So he's a flat character, despite the fact that he's always present in the story. See, it's not how much space the character gets that determines whether he's flat or round. It's what you know about the character that determines whether he's flat or round. One round character in this story, Robert Gusher, right? He's pretty round. Round is round to be. Round and firm and fully packed, as they used to say about some kind of cigarette company. Okay. What does Robert want?
that's not pretty bad.
He needs somebody to help share his help him share, or sympathize with his illness.
What do you make of this illness that he's got anyway? He's got this, I've seen this illness before in Poe. Poe wrote another story with a back character, a first person character, who's got this illness where all of his senses have become extremely sharp.
No.
I want to go. Do you?
I do. Can you go a little bit later?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
it's windy out, isn't it?
Yeah,
I didn't bring a coat. Listen.
Is that the wind?
Yeah.
And they've been reading all this stuff, he said, too. city.
So
in a storm, violent storm. So all of those elements combined then, a strictly rational 20th century modern mind would say, well, the city, hallucination. A hysterical hallucination, brought on by hysteria.
But did he
hear the sound because Robert Gresher heard the sound?
Well, he heard them because they
were in the story. For a while, yeah. And after a while, though, he starts saying, yeah, I did hear that. Could that have been the power of suggestion? Could have been. Now, we could speculate all night on that, just that point alone. But,
I don't think that you can dismiss the narrator's reliability on that basis alone. There's nothing to suggest that he was unreliable.
Exactly.
And he could have just closed his eyes and the wind knocked a tree in the room and killed that guy, you know, if you want to speculate, and then open his eyes and there's nothing there but dead.
Think about this. We talked about Poe's theory that in a short story you create a totality, a single effect, a unified effect. What effect was he trying to create here? It's a scary story. He intends for his audience to be scared. And just like, and Stephen King went to school on this guy. He talked to Stephen King a little bit about crap. This is how you scare people. Imagine being somewhere building a house that you're not familiar with. Out in the country, it's not in the middle of the city, it's a real dark night, and it's stormy and spooky, and somebody starts reading you this story. Even if you've heard the story before, you can get a little goosebump or two, I bet. It's a scary story, it's intended to be scary. So don't look for anything real deep and metaphysical here, like we were doing with Lycia. Sure, that was about the fear of death and desire for immortality, which is pretty metaphysical. But this one, it is on no such lofty level. This one is meant to scare the living through Jesus out there. And that's why his audiences loved it. Right? People love to be scared. Okay. Now let's move on to the Task of Amontillado. This is one of Poe's later stories. He wrote this later in his career than the other two we've looked at. And one of the interesting things about Poe here is that at this point in his life, he had somehow managed to develop a sense of humor. Because here's one thing that's really different. Now look, the setting's the same. Gothic, right? It's a dark, creepy, big old mansion kind of place. The characters are kind of the same kind of people. They're kind of spooky. At least the narrator is. But look at the tone of this story. This whole story is an enormous, fatal, practical joke. It's a practical joke. This guy, the narrator here, now is this narrator reliable? He's not. Fortunato apparently has been insulting this guy for years. We get the mention of repeated injuries, the thousand injuries of Fortunato, I born his best doctor. In other words, this guy has been on my case a thousand times. He's been after me, but then when he ventured upon insult, on adding insult to injury,
okay,
I vowed revenge. Okay, he just went one step too far. It's like having some guy who is just in your face all the time, you know, and bugging you and tormenting you and won't leave you alone, and you just try to deal with it, you know, you deal with your patient, you deal with it, and then he does something really, really crazy, like, oh, calls the cops and gets you framed for some crime, so you got to spend 3 or 4 days in jail. Or he fills up your car's gas tank with sugar. Or, you know, something just really mean-spirited. Okay? That's it. That's Popeye. That's all I can stand. I can't stand no more. I'm going to get this guy. I'm tired of this. I'm going to get him. I'm going to kill him. You know, and of course, he doesn't give us specifics here, but we've all read stories and seen movies in which a protagonist was just driven so absolutely berserk by the antagonist that he had to kill the antagonist. And that's fairly common in literature. I've seen that a lot. Think about Fatal Attraction. Remember that? He didn't want to kill Glenn Close, and he finally had to kill him. Right? I mean, that's very common storyline in literature. And so he just kind of leaps over most of that storyline because what he wants to focus on is the actual mechanism by which he kills Fortunato. Why? Why does he want to dwell on that? Okay, he's very proud of that because he thinks he sees himself as extremely clever to have been able to pull this off. He's committed a crime that's really a perfect crime. Who's ever going to find Fortunato? He tells you at the end of the story, hey, many years gone by. No one has ever found him. They never do it. He just disappeared. So it's pride for one of us to tell the story from the narrator's point of view. So I don't know whether we can say that he's unreliable. We don't like him very much, probably, because he's capable of murdering this guy, and he does suffer from the sin of pride, and his pride probably that led to this act in the first place. An insult is an attack upon someone's pride, it's not. So it's probably hurt pride that he's caught, and he's got too much of it. You know what excessive pride is called in literature? It's called hubris. H-U-B-I-S. Hubris, called overweening pride, excessive pride. Excessive pride is that old idea is tied up in the story. The title of the story, The Cask of Amontillado, is connected to the idea of pride. Okay? Amontillado is high-grade wine. And it's wine that only the very richest people can afford. And it's a source of great pride to even have such a whole cask. You know how much this is? It's equivalent to 2 hogsheads, barrels full of wine. It's a big barrel of wine. And supposedly real good wine. And so, what is it that enables our narrator to lure Fortunato down through all these dark, gloomy cellars to where allegedly this cask of Amontillado is?
Pride.
The guy's a snob. Fortunato is, right? He fancies himself an enormous connoisseur of wine, and that's the whole purpose for going down there because the narrator is very sly and approaches him. Got this, but I might have gotten ripped off. You know all about wine. And I could go get this other guy, but I really trust your judgment. You know, he really flatters the guys.
sucks up to him. And the guy says, well, of course, that guy. What does he say? He doesn't know how he got over him. Sure. So sure, you know, I'm your man. And he's very proud, right, of that. And it's just, what keeps him going, Fortunato? I mean, they go through, it looks like Dante's version of Inferno.
Yeah, it's that line.
It's a terrible place. And it's the idea that he knows he's the expert and he's going to show this guy. Plus, he's going to get to drink some of the guy's wine, which he's quite ready to. Even if it's not a Montegallo, he's going to drink it anyway, right? So it's a combination of pride, a little bit of drunkenness thrown in, too, that are involved. You know what drunkenness does to proud people? Yeah. Okay, but this guy also, think about this. Tell us how Fortunato is dressed. Now, you might not be familiar with the vocabulary, but it's on 716. He accosted me with excessive warmth. It's almost halfway down the page. Well, he had been drinking much. The man wore a motley. You know what motley is?
It's clown.
Yeah, it's the costume of a harlequin, a clown, a Renaissance clown. Oh, yeah, that whole idea, yeah. And the cap, a little pointy cap with a bell on it, and the pointy toe of shoes.
Oh,
why did he dress up like this?
It was during the carnival.
Mardi Gras. It's carnival, it's Mardi Gras. And people dress up like that.
Still do.
The world of Mardi Gras, don't they? Yeah. But he's dressed up. And we get the idea that Fortunato, he's probably an enormous big rhino of a guy. I think he's a big fat guy. You get that impression, don't you? And he's wearing this ridiculous clown suit.
He's probably loving it, huh?
Yeah, that would tell me that probably doesn't have a sense of humor. I don't know where he found it, but he found it for this story. So the visual effect of this scene is one of very dry humor. And the way Poe does this is by not going on and on about, isn't it funny, he's dressed up in motley and I laugh my ass off because he's wearing a ridiculous costume. He doesn't say anything about it, he just mentions it so that you, the reader, can laugh your ass off. It doesn't overdo it. Comedy shouldn't be overdone. It's a light touch. It's all kind of comedy. So he's given us some pretty good comedy here in setting up this scene. And that's why this tone is quite different from the tones of the other two stories. And in fact, you could almost say, in fact, you could say, and I will say it, that the tone of this story mocks the tone of the other two. The mockery is self-mockery. He's taking similar subject matter, certainly similar to the Fall of the House of Usher, because we've got a premature burial here. The guy's fixing to die by being walled up way under the ground. Prematurely be left to die. We've got all the same Gothic setting, don't we, that we had before. We've got a Gothic sounding tone. But when we read between the lines and we start seeing that this guy, this narrator, is laughing the whole time. He's laughing at this guy every time. Fortunato says something. The narrator turns it into a little play on words about you're going to die.
A little bit of sense of irony.
Quite a lot.
And this here one says, you're not a brother, but
The actual trial.
Yeah, now why would you be carrying the trial?
Yeah, why would you get a trial?
This guy was very
So, by the way, I'm glad you mentioned that, Paul. This is a good example of what's known as verbal irony. Okay? There are really two main kinds of irony. There's verbal irony,
which is irony of language. When somebody says one thing and means something else, sometimes means the exact opposite. And we've got a lot of that here in this conversation. You notice the difference, too, in style here? A lot of dialogue in the story. There's not much dialogue in the first two, but a different uses a different style here. When you're going to do comedy, you've got to have dialogue, or at least sight gags. You know, that's hard to do. Writing sight gags have to be seen. So create comedy and writing, you got to use dialogue. And, the other type of irony is referred to as cosmic irony. That's situational irony, okay? And it involves the concept of reversal, okay? Reversal might be an ironic situation. For instance, anybody know the story about Jack London, Build a Fire? Mm-hmm. You probably did. It's about a guy hiking across the Alaskan wilderness, 75 degrees below zero, a snowstorm, and he steps in, breaks through a big place with his eyes, and gets his feet wet, and he's got to start a fire, or he's going to die before he can get up. And he's got a whole book of matches there, and he does succeed in starting a fire, but in his haste to get this fire started, he started it under a tree that's covered with snow, and as soon as that heat goes up and starts melting that snow, snow falls off with his fire out. And then later, so he's trying to start a fire again. And now he's really cold. He's so numb, he can't even use his fingers. He's just, you know, barely able to function at all. And he manages to get a match lit. But in doing so, it lights up the entire book of matches. And it falls. That's irony. He's got the ability to start a fire. He knows how to start a fire. The expectation is that he's going to start a fire. But his plan is reversed. That's cosmic irony. Fate rained on his parade.
Is that cosmic irony? I don't know. The concept that you meet someone, say, two men working in an office building, one of them needs to go to donuts every day, and the other one jobs every day. And you got a jelly donut smoking a cigarette, and so one of them goes out to the table and goes out running, and the car hits him, and he gets
money. That's a cosmic irony. One person ought to die, and the other person dies instead.
Yeah.
That's cosmic irony. It shows up in a lot of ways. Here we've got a lot of verbal irony, because this guy's playing a game with Fortunato. The whole way, there's no cast. Montiato, there's no wine down there. I mean, there's wine. It's just wine cellar, right? But the wine he brought this guy down here to see doesn't exist. He brought him down here to wall him up. And we don't realize until the end of the story just how elaborate and well laid this plan was. Because,
yeah.
I mean, it's not just a coincidence that he happens to have some bricks and bag of ready mix down here.
And he's got to move the bones.
And all, yeah, the bones are all down there. Because, see, that place used to be, way back many years ago, a dungeon.
Now that's symbolic.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Can you use the fact that you see your map the entire time that you've got to cry and scream as you get out? You know, imagine and scream.
But, well, it's certainly evidence of inhumanity. In other words, he's being inhuman. That's an inhumane thing to do, to laugh at somebody as you're killing them. But I don't know that it goes to the issue of reliability. Reliability has to do with whether or not you should be expected to believe what he's telling. Do you believe what he's telling? I believe it. Now, the only thing that may call his reliability into question, you could make a topic for a paper out of the question of the reliability of this narrative. The thing that suggests most that he's unreliable is at the beginning of the story when he justifies this whole thing based on insult.
insult. And that might tell us that, well, the guy is a little bit maybe sociopathic. And being sociopathic, he might be feeding himself in the best light. In other words, he's the guy telling the story, right? So he can make himself look good. He can make the other guy look bad, because that's his enemy. He's got an axe to grind, in other words, right? Anytime your narrator's got an axe to grind, has some bias, then...